was a very good mate of mine, still is, from The Age. Russell, Barton, others. We would just get in our cars and we'd drive out to Angle Crossing, Major's Creek. We'd have barbecues. We'd kick the footy. We'd go for a walk through the bush, you know, and come back. And that was, you know, that was the weekend. I mean, huge amounts of drinking, parties. You know, there'd be parties at somebody's house, and you'd have it'd be a housewarming, or it'd be a farewell, or something like that. So, you know, a lot of social life, a lot of relationships, you know, would start up.
So you were single at this time?
My now wife, my then partner, Helen, was working in Melbourne. We'd met in 76, so we do go back. Is a journalist as well, was a journalist, with The Age, and then with the ABC, and ended up coming up to Canberra. I'm talking about Helen O'Neill, O-N-E-I-L, one L. Came up to Canberra as a radio reporter with Radio Public Affairs, and so she was reporting for AM and PM in, I guess, 81, like that, 82. She certainly covered the 83 election campaign, the Fraser Hawke election campaign in 83. She was the number two in the bureau, working to a fellow called John Mills, who sadly has died shortly afterwards, but he was a nice guy. And so when she moved up, we actually moved in together. We got a house in Red Hill. So previous to that, I'd been living in the Age flat in Forest. The Age owned property around the place, and there was a flat in National Circuit, which was a pretty spare kind of place. Actually, it was comfortable. But when Helen got here, so we had a bit more civilized lifestyle in beautiful Red Hill.
But the work in that sense was, as you said, work and social life was one and the same.
Yeah.
During the years that you worked in the press gallery.
Yeah.
Tell me about this building. I mean, what parts of the building, apart from your office in the press gallery, did you use every day and for one purpose or another?
Press gallery, non-members bar, canteen. Obviously, when the Parliament was sitting, the chambers. King's Hall. But you would be constantly roaming these corridors. You could go anywhere except for the corridor. You're right. You could go anywhere except for the corridor leading from King's Hall to the Prime Minister's office. And that was out of bounds. But anywhere else you would, you know, and so you had to... I've kind of mentioned this thing about getting out of Parliament, but it never quite worked. Most of your time was spent in Parliament, especially when Parliament was sitting, because the ministers were here. And yes, it's all very good to talk to a departmental secretary, a deputy secretary or something like that, but, you know, you needed to talk to the minister's office and build a relationship with the minister. So some of my ministers were Michael McKellar, Ian McPhee, Margaret Guilfoyle, you know, and I can really remember Margaret Guilfoyle's office was probably, it was on the Senate side, obviously, and it was in the far back corner, what I suppose is the southwest corner of the building, and it was so difficult to get to. It was a long walk, and there were little ramps and stuff like that, you know, roaming around this building. But I would often go down there. Her principal private secretary was a chap called Rod Kemp, who later became a minister. And I had some excellent conversations with him. I look back on those with great... You know, he was a bit of a warrior, as you'd expect. But he gave me a lot of time, and I really... I think we had quite a good relationship.
So the... Did you obviously attended sessions in the chambers?
Yep.
There was to, as a reporter, you sat up in the press gallery?
Yes.
Yep. How often was this a regular part of your job, or was it only when the ministers, the subject material that you were dealing with, was up for discussion?
Well, you do every question time. And I, for my sins, tended to do the Senate. So I wasn't in the reps. You know, the reps was where all of the action was. I did a lot of the Senate figures, like John Carrick, Ken Reet, some of the lesser lights, it has to be said, of the Fraser government, Ian Wilson, John Button, Gareth Evans. You know, so they were good question times, but it was much more sedate then and now, especially then. But yeah, you would always do question time. You would have to actually, you know, there was talking about the kind of routine of news gathering there. You would take your own handwritten notes in question time. Sometimes, if you were really clever, you could, before you leave your bureau, you could put your tape recorder on next to the squawk box and record question time that way. But then you had to go through the whole tape, so it was a bit inefficient. There was no substitute for being in there. You take your own handwritten notes. If there was a question that you were going to, which was news relevant and you were going to quote, you had to get the pinks, I think they were called, and greens from the respective chambers, which were the Hansard's essentially first draft, which they sent to ministers for approval. And if you got those, you could also, you know, get... Sometimes there was a dispute as to whether the minister had tidied it, or the minister or the parliamentarian had tidied up the quote, and if you were able to get the raw Hansard as opposed to what then, you know, so that was quite interesting. But it was again all amazingly paper based. These were carbon copies with handwritten amendments from Hansard or from the minister's office, you know, and you just basically had to get a physical hold of these things.
How did you find the experience in the chambers? Were they ordinary, or were they inspiring? What was your impression of effect of the way the chambers worked?
Well, in my very first times coming up to Canberra as a student journo, it was the possibly most thrilling thing I could possibly have done, to sit in the chamber. I thought that was I think I can remember Cairns giving his heart on the sleeve speech after he resigned, standing at the back bench. You know, again, so that was 75, you know, Whitlam government era. But even, you know, I mean, there were some great Hayden-Fraser battles, you know, and in the Senate it was always a kind of a second 11. You had a feeling it wasn't quite where the real action was. But, you know, occasionally there would be, you know, something quite sharp. John Carrick was the government leader in the Senate and the Minister for Education, I guess. I didn't realise what a distinguished career he had in the New South Wales Liberal Party. It's only something which I've since learnt. As I saw him, he was a rather old, and he also had a distinguished wartime service. As I saw him, he was a rather old, you know, shadow of himself. He had a bit of a shake as he spoke, and I felt it was, you know, he was not the most energetic defender and advocate for the Fraser government there. And as I say, there was a couple of quite, you know, second order ministers. Whilst on the Labor side, there was some, well, Ken Reed was very gentlemanly, but as I say, Button, Evans, you know, I do recall some of the others. And so there was a sense of opposition surge, I think. Look, it was like watching a really, really slow game of chess. You know, you had to be there for every move, but not much happened, you know, quickly.
So the seven of you would sort of one day descend on the Senate and or try to and or cover those Or how did that work out?
Nobody ever set foot in the Senate except me.
So you
were Michelle would occasionally drop in. Look, there were seating limits, so there were two seats for the age in the Reps Press Gallery, Michelle and whoever was the number two.
So you covered all the areas, all the matters that would be coming. So
for question time, yeah. That was the only time when it was really full. I referred before to sessional reporters. So sessional reporters were sent up explicitly to cover Parliament. But over time, that concept, pretty rapidly, fell away. The only person who was actually in the gallery, the only media outlet that was actually in the gallery at all times, was AAP, and they were providing a full service coverage, so there was no need for us to spend a lot of time in the gallery outside question time.
Although you did, you said you spent question time in the Senate.
With the exception of question times, the journalists tended not to be inside the gallery. Inside the Chambers gallery. Mm.
Now, some technical questions. What sort of equipment, if any, did you use during your days in the press gallery? I'm talking about the up to 1983.
Yeah. Typewriter, cassette tape recorder. Little micro cassettes, I think, were just coming in then, but it was mostly these larger, style cassettes.
What sort of typewriters are we talking about? Electronic ones?
Oh, no.
I mean, the old-fashioned...
The old-fashioned, hammer away, that's right. And then they'd be sitting on your desk, and if you needed desk space, you'd tip them up on their ends and use the desk space, for writing or whatever, or reading a newspaper.
Did that change at all over the years you were there up until 1983? I thought technology had started to sort of become a factor certainly from the early 80s onwards.
Not here. I'm pretty sure we, in 83, when I left the Bureau, we were still using typewriters. At the ABC, Helen used these Nagra equipment, and I see in the press gallery there's one of those which is on display. They weighed about half a ton, and they were manually edited. I can remember going around to seeing her in the office and she's done an interview with somebody and she's editing it, which involved literally splicing the tape. If there was an M or an R in the minister's answer, which would sound bad on radio, they would physically cut it out and splice them together. Amazing, painstaking work. Digitization just changes these work practices.
When you went out talking to, for example, departmental staff or others you talked about, how did you make note? Did you do it shorthand or did you have a recorder?
Combination. I had a bit of shorthand and you would take handwritten notes, but you would back it up with if it was on the record, you'd back it up with a tape recording.
And that was the case from the beginning when you were doing...
Yeah.
Can you remember what sort of tape recorders you were using?
I can't remember what they were called. I can jolly well see it in my mind. They were Nationals, I think, and they had a series of tabs at the front where you could, play, record, stop, start. Probably the size of a big Kleenex box. They were the ants' pants. As I say, micro cassettes were starting to come in. We used them a lot. We used to record, as I say, we used to record news bulletins, if we weren't there, or we'd record PM. PM might have an interview with somebody that we're going to, relevant to a story that we're writing, and so we'd record it and then transcribe that little bit of the interview.
What kind of shorthand did you use? Pitman's?
Pitman, yeah. Mm. When I started as a cadet, I was given shorthand classes. All of the cadets were given shorthand classes. We were cruelly irresponsible in terms of our disrespect for the Pitman's teacher who was brought in, Mrs. Travis, and probably should have learned a lot more than we actually did. But I still use a bit of shorthand. I mean, it's a great skill to have. A lot of it's gone, but I was capable. Well, I think most journos would have a few outlines. They very few had perfect shorthand. Court reporters, there's a reporter called Prue Innes, had perfect shorthand. And she would come back from a court with pages and pages of columns of excellent shorthand. For the kind of work I was doing, you really were going to be in a position where you only had a one-off access to the quote, like you do in a court. You'd always be able to back it up, but you certainly needed to have a record of generally where the conversation had gone, what the key points were. And sometimes journalists would compare their notes, literally compare their notes as to what had been said, and it was quite important to establish, you know, that as a record.
Tell me, what sort of interaction, if any, did you have with staff at OPH? I'm not talking about the other journalists, but other staff and people who were working here.
So ministerial staff?
Staff of any kind.
Yeah, well, certainly ministerial and opposition staff. So I mentioned, you know, Rod Kemp, and he just sticks in my mind. But you really had to get into the minister's offices. Obviously, the press officers were the press secretaries were the principal ones that you would deal with. Well, there was occasionally, you know, social opportunities. So we used to. Having described my AFL background, you'll understand my reluctance to participate in the touch footy that used to take place out in the front lawns here, where there's currently a much more important tent embassy. But we used to play touch footy out there, and that would involve journos and opposition staffers. So I can remember, for example, Wayne Swan was an occasional touch football player. Hayden staffers as well were there. So that was nice bit of. People also go running a lot from this building and do the two lakes at lunchtime. And that wasn't just journos, that was, you know, other staff people.
What about people like the Hansard staff? Did you have any dealings with them?
No. Never. Don't think I even knew them.
In which way would your workload...
Well, with the exception, of course, for the Senate Records Party, which was the annual, you know, end of session bacchanal, you know, that would take place. I don't know why Senate Records had the best party in the House, but they did. So, you know, there was a lot of drinking in the building. I don't want to overstate it, but I don't want to ignore it either. So, you know, if we're all in there working away at 6 and 7, 8 o'clock at night, there's ample opportunity to get beer. So most of the offices would have a fridge, a beer fridge, which was run on a kind of collective basis. Everybody would put in $5 or something like that, and then pay 50 cents for a can of beer, and you'd get through a couple of cans per night. I think it was Mungo McCallum who probably coined the phrase about how he was writing a column and it was a 6-can column. You know, there was lots and lots of drinking, and then I haven't even mentioned the parties. That's just kind of drinking at work.
Did you have a fridge in your office, in your gallery office as
well? Well, we didn't have. I think the Fin Review tried to do a fridge, but there was a News Limited fridge. Hmm. Finally, I guess economies of scale, soaked up the small competitors, and there was a News Limited fridge over in one of the offices by the press box, and that was the best one.
And these were regular.
And that was its name, the News Limited fridge.
Were the parties a regular function, or was there just certain times of year, end of sessions?
End of sessions, mostly, yeah. But also there were lots of, not lots, but there was occasional... like an industry association would have a function, and, you know, there would be, so essentially they're lobbyists, Now, there was one in particular, and it was the Wine and Brandy Producers Association, who had an annual dinner. I mean, I don't even have to say the rest, do I? There was one dinner that I went to that was took place at the old lobby restaurant, and it was just this most gigantic piss-up. I don't remember any brandy, I must say, but certainly there was a lot of wine.
And the press gallery members were invited to all these functions?
Well, they existed in order to, you know, impress the journalists. They were lobbying the media.
So they were not lobbying their politicians, but lobbying the media.
Well, they did that as well, but the annual wine and brandy producers dinner, I mean, they probably had a politician come along and speak. I can't remember the formal details, but it was essentially, you know, it was an availability of alcohol for journalists. It was not a complicated formula, I've got to say. Whether it worked for them is another matter. I mean, strictly speaking, in terms of whether they got any better coverage, I don't think they did, to be perfectly honest, but they certainly made some lifelong friends.
Now, you were obviously, during the time that you were in the press gallery, the DCs up until 1983, there would have been times when Parliament was not sitting and ministers, prime ministers were away. How did that impact on your work? Would you still stay here when there were sessions where had finished?
Oh, definitely, yeah, because the ministers still had their offices here. And that's one of the great things about old and new Parliament House, that it is always the centre of executive government, as well as being, you know, the centre of legislative.
What about if ministers and people travelled away from Canberra? Did you ever accompany them?
Yes, sometimes. I had a great trip with Ian Sinclair up to the Northern Territory when he was Defence Minister. I had a trip with Clyde Holding when he was Aboriginal Affairs Minister, so it must have been early 83, I guess, just after the election of the government. So, yes, occasionally they would, you know, organise a press tour and you know, you'd be away for 3 or 4 days and you'd get really great exposure to the minister, a couple of really detailed, you know, policy issues. I had another trip in the Northern Territory, which was put on, I guess, by some mining association, and went to places like Tennant Creek and went down holes in the ground in Tennant Creek, which was, you know, I mean, it was... For Canberra journalists, the industry trips actually, I don't think, were that worthwhile, because I never had that much expertise. The ministerial trips were fantastic. They were critically important. You couldn't do it enough, to be honest, you know, in terms of getting... Because you had to get exposure to the ministers, to the issues, to the details, to the staff, you know, and stuff like that. So those trips were good, but they were rare, certainly at my junior level.
Also, I thought you said there were specific ministerial areas of responsibility that you covered.
Yeah.
Was defence one of them, I thought?
Yeah, well, how did I do that? I don't know. I certainly never covered defence.
But you still got the trip.
Yeah. Yeah, good question. Don't know. Lost in the mists, that one. But certainly we stayed here. I mean, when Parliament... To answer your earlier question, when Parliament was up, the tempo fell dramatically. There's no doubt about that. There were still stories. It would be a time, you know, you would think, I'll write a feature. In those days, you know, you would not just be producing news, but you'd have an opportunity to write, you know, a couple of thousand words occasionally as a feature article, what's now an op-ed article. So more detailed analysis of issues, you rarely had opportunity to do that during Parliament. So there was that kind of opportunity when Parliament was up. But also, you know, to return to the earlier theme, Fridays in non-sitting weeks were pretty lazy days. Earlier deadlines for the Saturday papers, and basically an opportunity for lunch. So in those days we did used to actually go out to Friday long lunch as journos. I can think of dozens of restaurants around the place where we'd sit, you know, we'd leave the bureau, be away for a couple of hours, eat well, you know, drink a bit, but it was mostly social. Always talking about work, actually, but it was in a social environment.
So the pace of the work slowed down, and as you said, you would spend your time more doing the longer, considerate pieces of,
yes,
of report rather than reporting of the news of the day.
Exactly.
But one thing, I suppose, with thinking of today's media world, it would seem to be necessary to have some means of keeping in touch with what's happening. So if something breaks, you are immediately in the know. But how was that done in those days? Did you have no mobile phones? Didn't exist. So how did you keep informed if something was breaking news and you really had to? You should really have been back at the office rather than at lunch, for example.
Well, sometimes you didn't find out about it until you got back, and then that was there's no worse feeling than nursing a low grade hangover and realizing that there's some serious stuff that you've got to get on top of it. Occasionally, trusted people in head office would be given the address of the phone number for the restaurant. So occasionally a call would be put in. You know, if there was really something, call us at, you know, at the tandoori.
But did you have a responsibility, for example, to keep someone in your office here at all times?
Oh. Well, Michelle tended to be in the office at all times anyway. She was not a luncher. So maybe that was it. But no, there was no sense of designated driver, you know, designated reporter. Mind you, not everybody would... Like, I mean, you can't all go out to the same lunch. So there were different groups and not everybody would go to lunch, you know. So sometimes people would be staying around. It wasn't a fixed appointment. But did we arrange a cover for those times? Well, probably not, no. You just make sure before you went out that you had everything nailed down.
Tell me, you left the press gallery in 1983. Why did you do that? What led you to that?
I had applied for and was awarded a Harkness Fellowship by the Commonwealth Fund of New York to study and travel in the United States, which was a miraculous life changer for me. And so I left Canberra in about, I guess, mid-83. It was just after the election of the Hawke government. I can remember the dams case. Oh, I used to cover a bit of high court stuff at that stage. That was one of my rounds, and covered the dams case, which was very exciting. But shortly thereafter, left the gallery for the States.
Was there any particular reason for that, other than, I mean, an opportunity to did it have to? Did you see this as a means to furthering your career?
Oh, absolutely! Yeah. Oh, it. The fellowship no longer exists in this format, but the requirement was to undertake a course of study, and I had nominated the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where there's a mid-career course, a 12-month mid-career Master of Public Administration. And having won the fellowship, I then applied for that course and was accepted there, as was off her own bat, without the fellowship, my wife. So we were both enrolled in the MPA, which was a great experience. My wife, as she then was, we got married in 81. So it was also coming up to the 84 presidential election. And part of my application to Harkness was to travel. They have a requirement that you must travel. It was great. And I said, well, the travel program would be to travel as much as I can on the presidential primaries out of Boston. And so I spent a lot of time. Because it was the Reagan years, the primaries were on the Democratic side. And a lot of those taking place in New Hampshire, Maine, Georgia. Went down to Georgia with Jesse Jackson, which was a great experience. Gary Hart was there, exploded. The candidate finally selected was Mondale. I attended the, I guess, two or three presidential debates between Reagan and Mondale. We lived in Washington for a while. Helen came back early because there was a big ABC program starting up that she was involved with, but I was there for the last 6 months and began research on what turned into this book, The New Machine Men, which I published in 1986, because I did a lot of the interviews for that in the States, in Washington. So I didn't have all of those plans in mind in 83, but it was a... Look, I wanted to... I wasn't dissatisfied with journalism. I really loved that gallery life. And talking about it now, I'm just feeling so nostalgic for it. So there was... I didn't at all feel pushed away. I guess, like anybody, I was frustrated that you couldn't do the bigger stories. You know, that's part and parcel of the thing. I certainly wasn't disillusioned with journalism at all. But look, it was Helen who pointed out the Harkness thing to me. She'd seen a note on the board over at ANU for some reason. And I applied for, you know, in hope rather than in any, you know, confident anticipation. And when it came through, it was just seemed to be a great opportunity. I wanted to go to the States. I thought the presidential, you know, opportunity was... So I certainly saw it, to answer your question, yes, definitely, as a career development in journalism.
In journalism. So yes, you were still focused on journalism.
Yes, yes.
Right. Okay, look, well, I think we might stop here today because when I want to like to start on next would be when you joined the Prime Minister's staff in 1986. And I think this seems like a pretty good place to stop for now.
Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.